welcome to this Wednesday's Main Street on Prairie Public. We're glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, the Red River Market returns to downtown Fargo this Saturday, and Prairie Plates will launch us into another season of fresh, locally produced food, vendors, live entertainment, and community gathering. Plus, North Dakota cities are at the center of some of the state's biggest opportunities and toughest challenges. Matt Gardner, Executive Director of the North Dakota League of Cities, will join Main Street to talk about the issues shaping municipalities, large and small. And we begin Main Street today with Prairie Beat travels to Devil's Lake, where rising water is threatening farms, roads, and livelihoods.
What affects us a lot more than just the lake, too, is the size of our sloughs. We just have high water table and so much water in the area that every little slough that takes up 10 acres here, 5 acres there, just adds up to a whole bunch of acres.
How high is the water, Mama? 2 feet high and rising.
Well, hey there, I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Welcome back to another episode of Prairie Beat,
our weekly news podcast here at Prairie Public. Now, Danielle, I understand this week's topic hits a little close to home for you. Quite literally, you had some reporting earlier this week that I heard about rising floodwaters in Devil's Lake, and that's where you are from.
Yeah, that's correct. So yeah, I did grow up in Devil's Lake, rural Devil's Lake more specifically, and I grew up on a family farmstead. My dad is, and he was, you know, the fourth generation farmer for our family in the basin. And for anyone who may not know or understand the backstory of Devil's Lake, it's basically a glacial lake bed. So you have a lake there where folks settled and developed around there. And it's an expansive, flat landscape around it, which was formed when that glacier receded all those bajillion years ago or whatever it was. And so Devil's Lake, at the level it was developed around, it has no natural outlet. So as we will discuss today, that has caused a lot of pretty significant problems that continue to this day.
And when you say the problems continue to this day, I mean, I think a lot of folks in North Dakota know about the outlets that were constructed on either end of the lake. People know that it's flooding. But what I've been hearing from you in just our discussions around the office about it is that the outlets, while providing some relief, are not perhaps the solution locals are looking for.
Yeah. So if you go back even further, like back way back when my grandpa was a kid, Devil's Lake was at a very historic low of just 1401 feet in 1940. In the 30s and 40s, obviously, times were pretty hard, and they were in Devil's Lake. But the water came up around 15 feet or so over a period of about 15 to 20 years there. And that in itself created a lot of issues for ag producers in that region. My grandpa is passed away now, but he had a lot of writings, you know, about his life battling water, you know, in those times. And in the late 70s, early 80s, my dad came into the operation, so that fight continued. In 1993, the lake level was 1422, which is very low, especially in all of our recent memory. But remember, that's still over 20 feet higher than it was in 1940. So then it started raining and the lake came up 30 more feet.
That's alarming. And I guess given just the whole flat table of everything, even a little bit is a lot. So how does that even work, that a lake can come up that high and that fast?
The upper Devil's Lake Basin contains what is known as the Chain of Lakes. Many of those lakes were dry for a really long time. One of them is even called Dry Lake. And these lakes are connected to the lower basin through drainage and many coulees. They all drain south. So all this water flowed down into the main basin. And then what ended up happening was the basin filled to the top and it got worse because the water didn't have anywhere to go. So now we are limited on time today for Prairie Beat. We don't only have so much time. I'll have to give some cliff notes here. A lot of private property around the lake was impacted. And by that, I mean hundreds of structures, homes, businesses, and entire neighborhoods had to relocate. And as the lake level came up, it continued to back up into the northern basin there, where it flooded out a lot of farmers who were farming up there.
And that included your family farm operation.
That is correct. So the farmstead my dad grew up on near Church's Ferry Penn area is currently in the lake. It went under about 25 years ago. And my family is really one of many that's had to deal with it. You know, we're not the only ones. This week, I called Jeff Frith when I heard from back home about the water coming up again. He serves on the Ramsey County Commission, but he also manages the Devil's Lake Basin Joint Water Resource Board. In 2011, the lake reached a historic high of 1,454 feet, which made conditions in that area pretty unbearable. There are years, you know, where the pumps and evaporation are able to gain a bit of ground and give a little bit of relief to the region. And some winters, of course, you know, the snowpack isn't as heavy and it doesn't produce as big of a runoff, so that helps. But overall, you know, historically, the region has been in a wetter climate cycle. It's been raining a lot. In the last month, Frith says some portions of the basin received up to a foot of rain.
And of course, all that water runs down here at Devil's Lake. And so a lot of roads impacted, a lot of coulees flowing at capacity. And, you know, it's something that you would normally see in springtime flooding conditions, we're now seeing in the middle of summer here. Normally when those coulees are at a trickle or almost dry, we're seeing spring flooding within those coulees. And washed out a lot of roads. We currently have 34 closures in Ramsey County, 51 miles that we've logged so far that we've lost, you know, just within the past 10 days.
Now, I know you did that interview with Jeff Frith a couple of days ago, so those figures may already be out of date. How long will it take for that water to finish running off?
Frith says it can take as little as a couple of weeks or up to a month or maybe a little longer, depending on a lot of things, obviously. You know, we're entering a typically drier part of the summer right now. Hopefully they can get some help from Mother Nature in that regard. But in that time, there will probably be more road closures. When I talked to Jeff Frith on Monday, he said the lake level was currently 1,450.4, and that is getting pretty close to 2011's historic high. He says with these rains that just came in and the inflows, the level could rise another foot.
So with these levels approaching those historic highs, that has to have, forgive the pun, but ripple effects across the entire region. And as a former farm kid who grew up in a flooded lake, I'm sure you must know just a little bit about that.
I do, yeah. So if our audience will forgive me for breaking the fourth wall here today, so to speak, I asked a guy I know pretty well to explain it to us, what it's like carrying on as a farmer in the region. My dad had four daughters, myself included, obviously, and two of his daughters married guys who joined my dad in the family farming operation. My brother-in-law, Evan Shanefish, is one of them, who now owns and operates Webster Farms.
So I actually started in 2008 was my first full growing season. I worked as an employee for your dad, obviously. And then I got married in 2009. And then in 2011 is when I started farming, actually, on my own a little bit.
Now, remember what I said about 2011, which was the historic high. Evan and my sister remodeled an old farmhouse, moved in, and not long after that, the floodwaters practically raced up to their doorstep. They were driving through water to get to their yard every day. But farmers are persistent. Evan and eventually my other brother-in-law, Callan, who joined the operation, they learned everything they knew about not just farming, but doing it in a flood from my dad. And he has never given up on the operation.
Danielle, I find it so incredible that stories like this can really fade in and out of our collective consciousness, right? And we always talk about how the news cycle moves fast. Today's one big story is forgotten tomorrow because we moved on to the next big thing, the next shiny object. But what I'm hearing right now is that for more than three decades, a community here in North Dakota has been pretty much living in a disaster zone that largely still hasn't been resolved.
That is exactly correct.
My comment, I guess, was our waters hasn't ever left. You know, it's receded a little bit, but it's still right there. I would say from the high to now, we have maybe gained back 1,500 acres, something like that. And we have some of that back, but not all of that back. And there's still a fair bit of land under the water that we could be farming.
And what he just said there has been true for the last 30 plus years. Farmers who have stuck it out and kept going will gain ground one year and then lose it the next. The reason it's news today is because of how much water is currently being stored and how much is also currently flowing. Jeff Frith told me it's now beyond what local officials can really get their arms around, so they need help. They're having emergency briefings daily with various state entities, and they're exploring avenues to ask for state and even federal assistance.
So what happens then, if history is any indication, they'll get through it. Let's hope so, certainly. But it does sound daunting. Living near rivers in the Red River Valley, we've seen floods. They come and go, but this one stays.
Yeah, we've been talking about the ag industry, you know, specifically today, and that is a huge impact in the region. The flood causes upwards of hundreds of millions of dollars in lost economic impacts every year. It affects the whole community. The city is protected by a giant levee. outlets on either end of the lake, which are currently not able to run at capacity due to maintenance issues, they offer a little relief. The water has been great for recreation and tourism. People love to visit Devil's Lake. They love to go camping, fishing, you know, water skiing, all that fun stuff. But resort owners have suffered a lot, too. And when main industries in a community can't have predictable income streams or predictable seasons, it does ripple out to the rest of the community. Those are dollars that cannot be spent supporting other local businesses in the area. So it's a basin-wide problem. I've been talking to my dad about the flood, you know, pretty much my whole life, and now Evan and Callan are stepping up to the plate to take their own crack at it. And I asked Evan, what does he think should happen? If he could fix it, what would he do?
The state needs to pick a level, and that level, the lake needs to be set at that level. They can have a range, you know, keep it between, I'm not going to say a foot range because hopefully they'll pick a lower one, but they'll pick a range between 2 feet. They're going to keep the lake at this and buy out everybody underneath that. That's the solution to the problem.
He said buy out everybody underneath that. So what he's saying there is that folks still own land they can't use. That honestly sounds pretty traumatic.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, my family isn't the only one dealing with this. Everyone up there does it their own way. Some people hung it up and moved away. Others quit farming and tried other things. Farmers by nature have to be optimistic and hopeful no matter what, because it's a challenging industry without having to operate in a flooded lake bed. There's prices, weather, market conditions, input, output costs, varying yields, all these things. And I mean, the list goes on and on. And, you know, it's been tough for my dad. I did ask Evan about that, and he did say that he knows it has weighed on him. You know, he knows the next generation will have to really continue carrying that torch into the unknown future.
Definitely. Your dad, you know, he'll never give up on the water. He'll fight cattails. He'll fight water. He's going to do it for the rest of his life. And he always says to us when we get a big rain, he's like, well, it takes thick skin to farm. You got to. Got to have thick skin. And he said, you know, this has happened to me so many times, it just doesn't faze him anymore. It's a challenge that most farms don't have. And I think it bothers him a little bit that this thing has been passed on from generation to generation.
And for farmers like your dad, that's really it, isn't it? It is carrying it on into the future, passing it down to somebody. God bless him. And your mom, they had daughters only, but luckily they have some son-in-laws to carry it on. But that must be the thing that keeps them awake at night.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. All this time.
Wow. All this time, your entire life, basically. Well, this story has been unfolding now for a very long time and continues to do so. So I'm thinking we may be hearing more about the persisting challenges of living and working in the Devil's Lake region as the days and, I guess, years roll on, and with the hope that a solution can be figured out that benefits farmers, resort owners, and residents alike. Thanks for all of that, Danielle.
Absolutely. So, yeah, we'll be covering that in the Prairie Public Newsroom, as well as other stories. You can tune in to hear those as usual, or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
And we'll have more to discuss next week on Prairie Beat, but that will do it for us this week. I am Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
Welcome to another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Ian, talking about food weekly here on Prairie Public. And this week, we have a special guest to talk about the upcoming Red River Market, which starts at 10 a.m. on Saturday in downtown Fargo. I'd say it's North Dakota's premier farmers market. There's Biz Market in Bismarck, which is great too, and some other markets around the state. But Red River Market is my favorite market, and I attend it just about every Saturday if I'm in town. And we do have a special guest today who...
You think I'm special?
You'll recognize her voice.
Hello.
Ashley Thornburg, formerly of Prairie Public, now with Folkways, which organizes the Red River Market and does such a great job. And it's really an honor to have Ashley in today, who has a new role at Folkways. Ashley, tell us a little bit about that first, and then we'll get into the market and the food vendors.
Sure. Well, Folkways is a place-making nonprofit, creating experiences where people belong. And the mission behind this is to combat isolation and loneliness. And if you think about it, people used to get together all the time and have dinner parties. They'd be going out to movies. They'd be throwing dances, you know, whatever generation we're talking about here. People were getting together a lot. And now we live in this time of hyper connectivity with tech, but we're not necessarily seeing each other face to face. And I always think about the events that Folkways does as this is exactly what I'm trying to do every time I'm on vacation. I'll hop on a plane and I'll get out and I am always going to look for the best local food, the local artists. I want to get tips from a local. I want to ask three different people, you know, what's the best piece of pie to get or whatever it is, and then take that all in. And then all of a sudden, you can do that right here in downtown Fargo.
Maybe describe the Red River Market for us, because before you got this position, I would see you there and we'd chat quite often. So describe the market for us.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that I've only worked with Folkways since May because I have volunteered for the organization, I'm pretty sure, since the Christmas market existed in an alleyway. And now it, you know, is huge in the Civic Center. But the Red River Market is a place where dozens and dozens, we're looking at 70 plus food vendors, people selling jewelry, people selling beer, people selling food, people doing produce, people giving cooking demonstrations, all coming together and enjoying, one, the act of coming together and the act of getting food together in the same place. Humans are very, very social animals. And when you can create it as an experience, it's a place where people want to go, they want to gather, they want to linger. Like you said, you and I used to see each other there every week. And I would be there for the most part for hours. I would be there almost the whole market. In fact, I had a little routine. I worked for a vendor, so I could actually shop early. I would actually be done with all my market shopping at 9:45 a.m. And then I would just get to hang out the whole time and go see someone. You know, it's Fargo. There's 1,000% chance you're going to see somebody that you know when you go to the market. And then you just come, you grab one of the masala tacos from Namaste Kitchen, you grab a coffee from Thunder, or, you know, wherever you are grabbing your drinks, your food, all of the great vendors. And then you walk around and then you see someone else you know, and then you see someone else you know, and then you take in a performance from Kohlrabi Soup or watch a musical from the Gooseberry Park Players. All of a sudden, it's half your day, and it was just pleasant.
And dogs are welcome too, right?
Yes, they are. In fact, in October, there is a special day just for dogs, the Red Rover Day, which is one of the most popular. Opening day, this coming Saturday, 10 to 2, is the most popular one.
Yes.
But lots of great days. Friendship Day is a new theme for us this year, working on that mission to create experiences where people are belonging. And so if you can come and make a new friend or bring a friend to the market, just different ways for people to interact. It's almost a lost art, just meeting someone.
I agree. And since COVID, I've not been the best about interacting with folks either. And the Red River Market is a way for me to do that. Well, we're having a very fun discussion today with Ashley Thornburg, a special guest. You'll recognize that voice with Folkways in the Red River Market in downtown Fargo. And that market is happening this Saturday at 10 a.m. And Ashley, there will be talking about people probably. Some estimates sometimes are up around 10,000.
It's kind of bananas.
Yes.
It is the place to be in Fargo on a Saturday morning in the summer. You will just see so many people that you already know and have the chance to meet new people too.
And the mission statement I saw on the website is to create a place where all people can experience the joys of local food. And we'll get into some of the food vendors here, because I have some favorites.
I want to hear it. I trust your opinion.
Saigon Cuisine is one. Namaste Kitchen is one. Audubon. I love Sifa's African food. Mm-hmm. Little Brother is a good one. Humble Bread from Ada, Minnesota.
Right?
Their sourdough is amazing.
Yes.
Getting into some of the food vendors, the new ones, I did see Leela Thai.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, and and she just opened a new place over on 25th Street called Umi, I was at. But yeah, they'll have a mobile vendor there. And Fiona's Filipino Cuisine, that's always a good decision. I don't think folks realize that these vendors are curated. I don't think that they like leaving anyone out, but there is a philosophy with a lot of these vendors. And it's just something to take into consideration when you're going there and to think about that this is an artful event.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. You know, I remember hearing an interview about a disaster response personnel. And she said, you know, you only know about me when I'm not doing my job. And I think that's really true in things like experience curation is we've all been to an event where the line to the bathroom was too long, where the coffee was cold, where the ice cream was melting. And you really notice when people don't put thought into an event. And, you know, there's this saying, people ignore design that ignores people. And when you go to an event that you can feel people have thought this through from your perspective, it's an invitation to linger. And think about that in today's world. What a protest it is to say, actually, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to take a breath. I'm not going to go on to the next, to the next, to the next.
It's fun for me to just go around from table to table and say hi. Me running this Fargo-Moorhead Eats Facebook group, you make a lot of friends in the food community.
Right, and a lot of diverse friends, too. You're bopping around from ancient and heritage grains to having barbecue to having food that is from Vietnam to having coffee to having corn dog creations. All sorts of different things, you know, in a world where travel is still pretty available and fairly affordable, but you can't go to everywhere, but you can travel around and try all these things.
I think part of it is highlighting the refugee community because refugee resettlement in North Dakota, particularly Fargo, has had a very positive effect on the food scene. And I think you see that with Audubon. I think you see that with Saigon Cuisine. There are a few other vendors. And I really, really enjoy that component of it.
Yeah, well, you might be interested to know about our new initiative about clubs. And specifically this Saturday, one of the clubs that we are featuring is the Growing Together Community Gardens. A lot of people in the Fargo-Moorhead area know the name Jack Wood, and basically it's synonymous with tomato, right? And he just has these garden plots on the south side of town, and people are coming from all walks of life, from all ethnicities, and getting together and gathering food. And then you might say, like, oh, what does this taste like? You know, here's how we're using it in, you know, Morocco, and here's how we're using it in Japan. And you can create these little fusions and these little conversations of people coming together who might not have a shared background, but they have this shared sense of, for want of a better term, strangers in a strange land, right? You can do that, and they have this shared experience, and then you learn from each other's culture. And food, as you know, is one of the great places where you see the interaction of culture and the way to infuse this interaction back into it. People are social animals, and so it feeds this social need that we have for belonging, which is the whole mission.
Well, where can people find out more about the Red River Market? Social media?
Yeah.
The website?
Yeah. Facebook and Instagram. The handles are We Are Folkways. And then the website is folkways.org. You can check out all of the different events. The Red River Market is our flagship program. That's the one most people have heard of. But as we mentioned earlier, we have the Night Bazaar. We have a Christmas market. There's a sauna that goes around. A number of initiatives out of this little placemaking nonprofit.
A lot of good stuff for the community. Well, Ashley Thornburg, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks
it was
for
great
having me,
talking
Rick.
With you. People love hearing from you, so it's great to give an update too. So thanks for coming in.
I'm going to keep that recording and give it to my husband. People love hearing from me. Just kidding.
This has been another edition of Prairie Plates here on Main Street. I'm Rick Eon. We'll talk to you next week.
Still to come on Main Street, catching up with cities large and small in North Dakota. We'll visit with the North Dakota League of Cities. That's next. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Whether you live in one of North Dakota's largest cities or a town of just a few hundred people, local government touches you every day. It maintains streets and water systems, provides police and fire protection, plans for growth, and works to create communities where people want to live and do business. But cities today are also facing rising costs, workforce shortages and challenges, housing challenges, and changing expectations from residents. The North Dakota League of Cities serves as the voice for all incorporated cities across the state, providing advocacy, education, and support for local officials. Joining us today on Main Street is the League's Executive Director, Matt Gardner. Matt, welcome to Main Street.
Yeah, thank you, Craig.
Really pleased that you are with us, Matt. And for listeners who may not be familiar with your organization, what is the North Dakota League of Cities and what role does it play for communities across North Dakota?
Yeah, well, I'm very proud of the League of Cities, and my few-minute answer is not going to do it justice, but the League of Cities started way back in 1912. And when you go through the old documents, it really hasn't changed. It really served as a platform for cities to get together and talk about best practices, what works, what doesn't, you know, so that hopefully if somebody makes a mistake, others can learn from it. And those early documents, you know, mention that. So we do a lot of the same. We get our members together a few times a year and we talk and we visit, we do sessions, we learn from each other. You know, in the interim, we provide a lot of resources to communities. We have model ordinances that they can utilize. You know, they're not off the shelf ready, but they can adjust them to their needs. And then, you know, obviously the advocacy piece. You know, we're really that conduit between our communities and the legislature at both the state and federal level. So we try to educate our lawmakers on what our communities are up to. So we do a lot of great things, and I'm very proud to be their executive director.
Very interested in that relationship, and we'll chat about it a little later. But now, Matt, you spend a great deal of time with mayors and city council members and city administrators. And when you step back and look across the state, what's your overall assessment of the health of our cities today?
Yeah, I love this question. I like to say dynamic, I think, is a great word for them. Because no matter what community I go to, they're all different. They all have that one thing. Some of them have multiple things, but they at least have one thing they're proud of. You know, if you go to the city of Alice, North Dakota, Alice Cooper has officially been there and gotten the keys to the city. I mean, they all have their story. They all have that one thing, and they all care deeply about their community. So I like to say they're dynamic. And just I like to give some stats. And, you know, Craig, you mentioned 57 cities. There's actually 355. Unfortunately, in the last about 4 years, we had a couple cities need to unincorporate, and whether that's population loss or just, you know, what the case may be, but they decided to incorporate. So we have 355 communities and a couple other numbers. 307 of those are under 1,000 population,
yeah.
And 263 are under 500. So about 70% of our cities have under 500 people living in them. So that is a dynamic when you have a Russo and a Fargo in the same state.
And everything in between.
That's right.
In those conversations that you have with folks, are there certain issues that come up in almost every conversation? Or is there a line there that this is what the urban folks worry about and this is what the more rural folks worry about?
I would say it's both. So if you visit any city, you name it, infrastructure is a priority. Whether that's water, wastewater, sewer, roads, bridges, streets, you know, we're in the infrastructure business. I mean, that's stuff that generally you don't think about, but, you know, when you got up this morning and your toilet flushed, boy, we were grateful. We turned on the sink and everything worked, we're pretty grateful for it. And that's what our communities are really dialed in on. And a lot of it comes down to funding. You know, I think people feel the pressure of those funding mechanisms, you know, coming locally. So it's really a local and state partnership that gets that infrastructure built. The other one is staffing. You know, we're talking about that a little later, but you know, in your real small communities, you know, how do you find, you just don't have that pool of individuals to draw from. So, you know, one that really comes up quite a bit lately, it seems like, is just the civility and the decorum between the citizens and their local governments. I mean, the mayor is really your neighbor. That's the value of local government, as they, those decision makers are living in the communities in which they govern. So everything they do also impacts them. And I think we can all disagree, but we need to find a better way to disagree is what I hear.
I feel that North Dakota may be a little better than the rest of the country when it comes to that. Would you share that belief?
Yes, I would. We have a lot of tough decisions ahead of us. You know, you look at modern agriculture, technology, you know, societal challenges with individuals and people. We have some big challenges facing us, and luckily they're probably not to the scale of other places across the country, but they do impact all North Dakotans. And I think we're kind of at an inflection point in some of these issues that we got to overcome over the next few years.
I want to dig into housing just a little bit more. It sure seems to me that where I live in Horace, Fargo, not far away, and even in smaller communities, housing shortages, it's a common concern, affordable housing in particular. What are cities experiencing and what solutions are beginning to show promise?
Oh, man, that's a big question. We could spend 3 hours talking housing. But you know, you mentioned Horace. The former mayor of Horace, Corey Peterson, used to be on my board of directors, and I would talk with him, and you know, 300 housing building permits this year, 400 building permits. I mean, it's amazing the amount of activity going on in building in the city of Horace. I've also seen stats where it's growing, like the oil patch grew, you know, back when we had the big oil boom in North Dakota. So that comes with a lot of challenges. But when you zero in on housing, yeah, big or small, communities need housing. I was in Granora lately, and the community there was working on a housing project. And so one working definition that we're trying to get away from, I would say, is affordable housing and more focus it on attainable housing. You know, it's attainable housing for residents. And you also may have heard Congress, you know, Senate and House has passed the 21st Century Road to Housing Act. We need to dissect that a little further. Still needs the president's signature, but we hope there's some tools in there as well to utilize. But you know, communities, they're taking it into their own hands too. The city of Jamestown, they're working with a couple of developers, and they basically went 50-50. The developer pays for half of the improvements and the city pays for half. And when the individual who wants to build on that lot buys a lot, there'll be no special assessment. So I think there's getting to be some of that. Just the ideas are churning out there to figure out how can we get attainable housing in North Dakota.
People are shocked when I tell them I came from Wyoming, and as you know, that this concept of specials was foreign to us. We knew about it, of course, when we started looking around at what a place to buy. Why do we have to have specials? Is there a way around that where communities could save and then spend? Or are specials just something that will be with us?
Yeah, again, this is a long conversation. You know, the portion you mentioned about save and spend, you know, there's a case here in a city in North Dakota where they were going to do a special assessment district on a road improvement project, and it was in a business district. Well, there's a process where you can protest out of the special assessments, and they did. But the project back then, I can't remember how many years ago, was less than $1 million. Well, now that project is over $2 million. So if they would have allowed that project to go forward then, it would have been a lot cheaper. So I think when you think about the time value of money, sometimes just saving for it does not always work out in the end. And, you know, this infrastructure has to be paid for somehow. You know, so whether you tax the entire city, you know, for all the infrastructure in the city, or you do special assessments and you try to, you know, for those that benefit the most from it, you know, it's always going to be one of those things that's debated, I think.
So let's move on. I want to talk about workforce. How difficult, Matt, is it today for cities to recruit and retain the employees they need for essential services? We hear all the time that it seems to be a big problem.
Oh, definitely. Workforce is a challenge, and I might break this up into small and big communities. Hmm. You know, small communities, when you're a population of a few hundred people, just your pool to recruit individuals from is very small. And one of the roles we have in a city is called an auditor. And I would say, like in Wyoming, that might be a clerk something like that. But usually the auditor is that appointed official, the lead staffer, you know, for that community. And, you know, they have to worry about government accounting. All cities in North Dakota follow the same rules and regulations, you know, for auditing purposes and things. So finding those individuals that can do that audit and that those roles at a small community can be difficult. Then you compete for equipment operators to remove snow, or if you have your own water system, you know, those individuals all have to be certified. So in small communities, just find that person to do it is difficult. And then big communities, yeah, everybody's hiring, right? I mean, there's a lot of good jobs out there. I live in Washburn, so I live in coal country. You know, so if you're Washburn, Underwood, Beulah, Hazen, Stanton, you know, those communities, and you need an equipment operator, you know, they can go work on the mine for a significant wage. So, you know, we're always going to have that challenge. A lot of our fire departments and ambulances are ran by volunteers, you know, and just the nature of volunteerism, you know, has changed over the years with different generations. So that's getting more difficult. And then just public safety in general, you know, finding those fire department folks, those police department, that are just hard positions to fill. You know, there's just not that high a wage, you know, for the type of work you're doing.
Are there policy suggestions that you have in your back pocket, Matt, that could certainly help with some of these issues that are especially impactful to small towns?
You know, the state has worked with us over the last few bienniums on different programs. You know, they're kind of the mantra, back the blue, you know, different retention programs, you know, and those things do help, you know, ways that we can retain officers in our community. So, you know, we look to work with the legislature on that, but, you know, it's, North Dakota is a small state. We have less than a million people, you know, which is one thing that makes it great. But at the same time, you know, sometimes it's hard to find the job, the people to do the work. But we're always looking at ways to do that. Housing is one of them. If you're going to attract a workforce for the jobs in your city, as well as those public employees, you know, you need to have housing. So it's a big topic.
I'm enjoying my conversation with Matt Gardner. He's the executive director of the North Dakota League of Cities, which is the voice for all 355 incorporated cities across the state. Matt, we've mentioned infrastructure a couple of times. People don't think about it, right, until something breaks. The toilet doesn't flush as you, or the water doesn't come on. What are the biggest infrastructure challenges facing North Dakota cities today? And how are communities trying to just keep up?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And I think you'd get a different answer. But, you know, when I visit around the state, I hear a lot about water and wastewater. You know, we've been pretty blessed in the state of North Dakota with our oil tax revenues. And a portion of our revenues are put into our resources trust fund that helps fund drinking water projects, flood protection, regional water supply, you know, things like that. And we've been very blessed. But our oil field is maturing. So likely some of that, those funds that we're used to getting may not be available. So we really got to look at that drinking water program, which we're doing through the State Water Commission, Department of Water Resources, and the legislature. So that's something we got to look at. And the other one is wastewater. You know, I always joke around, I think it's people's least favorite form of water, mm-hmm. right? But it's very important if it's not working. And really right now, there's not a good grant program, a good cost share program. There's lending opportunities and bonding and things that communities can do, but there's not a good cost share. So we've been trying for the last few bienniums to work on a program there, and we're not going to stop, but it's really working in partnership with the legislature, trying to figure out, you know, the funding source and if we want to get in there. But one thing I'd like to just talk about a partnership is in some water systems, we use beverage grade CO2, and it's just a process of the purification process for water. And we utilize CO2 to make beer and pop and all kinds of things, but fertilizer and actually putting it in the ground, you know, for credits is highly available. So sometimes we have a hard time getting CO2, and some of our communities in the state partner together to put some extra storage in a community so that they have access to it, so that, you know, that we could have that reliable resource. And so I think communities all the time are trying to work together to figure out ways to solve these complex challenges and learning from one another. And that's one thing the league does, you know, we try to facilitate those type of partnerships.
You mentioned earlier how proud people are of their hometowns. We all want our hometowns, I think, to be vital. What are you seeing when it comes to downtown redevelopment and creating vibrant community centers that you would like to point out to us?
Oh, it's great. I would say they're getting very creative. You know, there's a lot of historic buildings across the state of North Dakota, and they're finding alternative uses for them. You know, mixed use, they're making plazas, all kinds of things. There's a, and I believe it's not operational right now, but there was a self-serve grocery store in one of our small communities, you know, where they tried that because staffing was an issue. One thing I'd like to point out, Crystal, North Dakota. I don't know if you've been there before, but northeastern part of the state. But, you know, an old C store was operated for a long time, closed down, and the community really banded together. And it was a public-private partnership, which brought that C store up and running again. And, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, food, economic development, all the different things. But to some communities, just having that C store is a big deal. My family and I, we volunteer in the city of Wing. They have a movie theater in Wing, North Dakota. And volunteers, you know, on weekends when they have movies, we all take turns volunteering at the movie theater. And that building could have been knocked down years ago, but just some people banded together in that community, in that region, to make sure it's up and going. So the state has programs, you know, like Renaissance Zones programs that help with that. There's different state grants. So again, it's just this partnership, you know, local involvement from the citizens, local government, and the state, you know, working together to make these communities vibrant in their own way. They're all different.
Are there other things that one or two communities are doing that are particularly innovative that others can learn from? And give me an example of how that energy transfers in North Dakota from one community to the next.
Yeah, boy, you know, it's hard to pick out one or two. You know, one that comes to mind is last year, our city of the year was Castleton. So every year, the League of Cities, we do a application process. We get applications for city of the year, and it's really kind of our landmark award we give out every year. And city of the year was Castleton, North Dakota. And I'm lucky to serve on the committee that helps pick these and get to read the application. But one thing that stood out to me was they get youth involved in their community. So they get youth involved at the council level. They talk about city planning, how they make sure that the public is there, but also the youth is there. And I have seen that as I visit around other cities, is they either ask me, how do we get our youth engaged, or they're trying to find unique ways to get their youth engaged. And to me, that's really the what's next for these small towns, especially, and our bigger communities, is what is the youth looking for? What kind of activities, you know, what are they looking for? And, you know, bringing them up to speed on what it takes to run a community, because, you know, it takes a village, right? I mean, it takes everybody to run these. But I would say, you know, just really that youth engagement. And then also, you know, North Dakota, we're an ag state, ag and energy. And that is changing. I mean, modern agriculture is changing. Technology is changing. Oil industry is changing. And I think those communities that can, you know, embrace, you know, that technology and those changes, it's not easy. But I think those are going to be ones you'll see improving for the future.
I want to talk about population briefly, Matt. There are communities that are growing, but there are also many communities that are losing population. First, is it generally a rural-urban scenario there, or is that not always the case? And then I want to ask you about the decisions that really shape local leaders when it comes to a community that's population is just not holding its own.
Right. Yeah, that's a difficult one. You know, we hear a lot that the population in North Dakota is growing, which it is, which is a blessing all the way around. I mean, it's an advantage for us. But you're right, some communities are getting smaller or holding even, and some are growing. And what I find interesting is when, and this will be a significant challenge for those that are shrinking, is that the population is getting smaller, but the infrastructure in the community is not. You know, when you think of a household 30 years ago, you know, I can't remember what it is, 3, 4, 5 average, right? Now it just might be 2 people in a house or 1 person in a house. So your tax base, those individuals that are paying taxes, are having to pay for a larger share of that infrastructure. And it's not that it's gotten any more, it's just that there's less people using it. So I think that's gonna be a big challenge that they face going forward. And our growing communities, I mean, you live in Horace, growing pains are real. You know, how do you what's the next development? Where's the city planning? You know, where's the next housing development go? The roads, and you know, if you have community members who grew up in these towns that are growing, you know, they just wanted to grow old and live there the rest of their life, and you know, they see this growth. So I would say financially, and just the, you know, the social concerns from citizens, you know, in these growing communities. You know, we see it. We're seeing it today. We'll see it into the future for sure.
We have more to talk about with Matt Gardner, the executive director of the North Dakota League of Cities, and we're going to continue that conversation on Monday. So we hope you'll return. But for now, Matt, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Yes, thank you.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 8th. Republican William McKinley was considered a strong presidential candidate in 1896. He had a long record of public service. He enlisted in the Union Army in 1861, rising to the rank of brevet major. He also served two successful terms as governor of Ohio. His politics appealed to Republicans, but he also attracted a broader range of voters. He was seen as a self-made man who radiated competence and reliability, qualities that appealed to voters during that turbulent 1890s. McKinley's opponent was Democrat William Jennings Bryan. He was known as an accomplished orator. As a young man, Bryan was dubbed the Boy Orator. He served as Nebraska's representative in Congress and began to believe that the presidency was within his reach. Bryan believed the gold standard favored wealthy industrialists and bankers at the expense of farmers and workers. On this date in 1896, he delivered what became known as the Cross of Gold speech at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. He explained his opposition to the gold standard and declared, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Bryan believed his position on the gold standard would have broad appeal among farmers and laborers, and that he could ride the issue all the way to the White House. But his hopes were dashed as the election results came in. North Dakota's results were somewhat surprising. Although the state's economy was heavily based on agriculture, North Dakota farmers and ranchers were not swayed by Bryan's opposition to the gold standard. Voter turnout was heavy, with some districts exceeding 90%. McKinley won all three of North Dakota's electoral votes. Although Bryan carried most of the western states, their smaller populations meant fewer electoral votes. McKinley won the more heavily populated northern states. Bryan ran again in 1900 and 1908 with the same results. As for the gold standard, the United States abandoned it for domestic transactions in 1933 and ended the international convertibility of the dollar into gold in 1971 under President Nixon. Today, the U.S. dollar is backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government and managed through monetary policy by the Federal Reserve. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
President Trump says the ceasefire with Iran is over. The U.S. launched retaliatory strikes on Tuesday, and Trump is threatening to hit the country again.
If we make a deal with Iran, I'm not sure that will stick.
What's next in the war with Iran on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that wraps up this Wednesday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, North Dakota's long-awaited military gallery has paused after private fundraising efforts fell short of expectations. Amy Dalrymple from the North Dakota Monitor explains what happened, how lawmakers are reacting, and what the project's uncertain future could mean for taxpayers and veterans. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.